Yeah, I think, Chairman, that subcommittee is all this.
Well, the, there's not that many of us here, we just well talk about it. The office help staff of the outfit that runs that is a lady by the name of Sharon Newsom. She's the head of the Congress Conservation Society, which is.
But I don't think they have anything to do with conservation. I mean, they're not, that's not.
Not just paying their salaries, all that, anyway, that's beside the point.
Well, I don't know. I kinda thought we had made some kind of statement with, move that bill to a certain budget, I wasn't sure we'd find that.
Do you think, I don't know, the troll logs, I was talking to the other neighbors, and it seemed to be, I don't know whether it's any damn good or not, I can't.
Hard to argue against it.
Yeah, I don't know where it goes, but $65,000.
The thing that I don't understand about it, I know what it is, you know, us guys in the hell of a game, we pay for our own, you know, but we don't do things that way anymore.
Let me go get Grogan.
That's what that's all about, eh?
I just wonder, well, I know the red, made a couple comments about the police and everything, these things, right?
Yeah, Christie.
Well, I don't know, what I can't understand, Jim, is why Fish and Game doesn't have somebody reconciling those things, you know? I'd like to see the book.
I don't know, I don't think about the program, I'm just on the co-sponsor, so Freeman and Talkin.
All right.
Put it in there and get it off their chest.
Well, let's see, come on, Grogan.
I had it last year, and then I came back with it. Supplemental, it's bigger next year, yeah.
I don't know if he has enough resources budget, what do you mean?
We got one resources budget number. Troll log program.
Oh, yeah.
What's the number?
Well, $65,000, that's what we're talking about, $70,000.
All right, moving to ask unanimous consent to add.
50.
$50,000.
Well, they got.
That's fine.
They got a supplement.
Forty.
Okay, 50. Is objection motion to 50?
Object.
Okay, there is objection. All in favor? All opposed?
Hey, Bob, would you get a copy of the log book?
There are several floating around.
You find them, I'd like to see what it is.
Throw it off, Ernie, I guess somebody here will talk to you about it.
Wait a minute, let's finish up this development now. All right, page three, the nearest I can tell, what's open is page 327 and 39, is that?
I don't know what 27 is. Tokyo office, I'd recommend go direct from Dave, and I think Thalma was the one that was concerned about that, I think we should just go to the governor's figure.
Okay, I moved governor's figure on page three, Tokyo office. Okay, if there's no objection, that'll be done. Page 27 was, no, that's closed, all right. 39?
39, the power authority, I met with them today, and I'm pretty well satisfied that they're getting the thing underway, and of course, there's a couple pieces of legislation coming through, and some amendments and appropriations. Only question I have here, in talking with them, is that the director mentioned that he talked with Ernie about a $250,000 bid for something in, what is it?
Oh, that's that, you mean that letter from Rutherford about, this here, direct wire contact?
I didn't know whether you were interested in that.
Well, I'm interested in it, but I'm going home this weekend, and meet with the Thomas Bay Authority, we can take care of that in a free conference, if it's worthwhile. I wanna talk to Greening about it, and permanent confirmation.
Governor's figure.
Okay, governor's figure's moved on page 39, if there's no objection, that'll be adopted, is that about size of it, Bob?
That's the one.
All right, okay. I can't talk anymore.
Why don't you bring a bottle up here?
I
That top it off at Trunk and Finance, Chairman.
Well, you should have been here with the names of Bradshaw and Rachel and Strandberg and those guys. You have some real dummy.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Where we spend money now, I can't think what happened.
Okay, there will not be a meeting at 8:30 tomorrow morning, okay? Bring the committee to order. The first bill Mike took up is House Bill 783. Duncan is the chief sponsor of this bill, and Marlene Lund is the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Regional Arts Council, is also here to testify on the bill. Jim is chief sponsor, Mike can lead off, and then Marlene can testify on it.
I'll just say very few words, and Ledger kind of explain what the program is, which would be much better. It's not a, if you'll recall, last year, Mr. Chairman, we put in the budget, I believe, I can't remember the exact amount last year, $8,000 for each of these art camps. We did the program at that time. There's one in Sitka, with Southeast Art Camp, that Alaska Fine Arts in Anchorage, and the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. Instead of approaching it that way, this year, I decided to go this way, because the governor's work on the art council, but it always leaves people wondering where their money's at. One of the important things about this appropriation is that I think the art camps have to know early whether or not they have the funding. So we're still looking at the time program. Because it starts right at the beginning of our fiscal year, and they have to bring in outside people. And so I think the appropriation is the way to go. I think I just defer to Marlene at this point, a very clean program.
All right, Ms. Lund, would you like to have a seat at the end of the table? I always apologize because a lot of times people are about 5'9" or so, they can't see over the books and paper, but I think we can hear you anyway.
I'll just scream. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I don't want to take much of your time on what I realize to you is a very small bill. It's a very major concern to the three fine arts camps in the state, though, and I will speak about them extremely briefly. Unfortunately, the Alaska camp in Anchorage and the music camp in Fairbanks cannot be represented, mainly because it's so very difficult and so expensive to travel here. So I'm, in my limited fashion, attempting to speak for all three. The budget information on the camps, which of course is going to be of concern to you, is available in great detail, and that is all, I believe Representative Duncan has all that information, and I'm sure if you have any questions, either he or I could respond to those, so I won't go into those in detail either. As he mentioned, our programs offer educational services in the arts areas, not only in music, but in dance, drama, visual arts, and literary arts, that happen at the beginning of July. We have to hire faculty up to a year in advance to bring them in, simply because we're trying to get art professionals from across the U.S. And therefore, we really have to have some idea of whether we're going to have the funds to run the camps prior to July 1. Last year, that was not possible because of the last-minute decisions on budget. And I would make one other point, that is that the camps serve a great many junior and senior high school students from throughout Alaska, not just from Sitka, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. Our southeastern camp has around 150, of whom by far the majority of the students come from 19 other communities besides Sitka. In Anchorage, I believe 25 communities are represented, and Fairbanks brings in students from King Cove, Bettles, Bethel, Kotzebue, and all over the place. So these are not just urban opportunities. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, and particularly on curriculum or information about my camp, but I have general information about the others also available.
Did you operate under the Alaska Hire Law?
I'm not really familiar with that, so I rather doubt that I can say that we do.
You talking about bringing in people from outside. I just wondered if there's any Alaskans operate this.
Most of the faculty are from Alaska, but where we need professional artists in some areas where we don't have artists in the state that have a teaching experience and so forth, we go outside the state. So we're bringing, in other words, we're exposing students to professional artists and musicians of the highest possible quality that we can bring. And we certainly hire Alaskans if Alaskans are available, but we're talking about an extremely specialized program, which is why the camps are so costly. And we simply can't find people, in all cases, in the state that can do the job.
Yeah, well, basically, what would, we'll say the university, you see, you're the most familiar with the University of Alaska.
No, Southeast Alaska Regional Arts Council's Southeastern Camp.
All right, that's $15,000, actually, what would you spend for it?
It's part of our total budget of $59,000, so I couldn't really zero it out. But the funds, the total cost for the camp go for faculty salaries. We have 20 professional faculty, artists and musicians, teaching at the camp. For transportation for the 20 faculty and 15 staff, they also, of course, need salaries. For the room and board for all of the 35 faculty and staff, for all of the student costs, for renting the entire Shelton Jackson College campus for all of their dormitory space and all of their classroom facilities. The cost of bringing in supplies for all the arts areas are rather expensive, and those are all broken down item for item in the Southeastern budget. And the other two camps, I believe, have just about the same cost factors.
Okay, how long, Ms. Lund, how long have these camps been operating?
I don't know the exact dates for the other two. Ours has been operating for 4 years. This will be the fifth. And I believe the University of Alaska Summer Music Camp has been going for, well, as long as anyone can remember. And I believe the Anchorage Camp has been going for 11 years. The UA Summer Music Camp is far older than that, though, I believe.
Are there further questions for Ms. Lund?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Buckle.
I move brief about House Bill 73.
All right. Is there objection to Ms. Buckle's motion to report out House Bill 783? All right. One technical question of Ms. Lund before we do this. All the camps going to be finished by August 31st?
They will, sir. However, we may not have all our final buildings by that. We have buildings that are extremely detailed and large, and some of those will be coming in after the 31st. However, we'll know the cost and we can encumber the funds.
Okay.
They will be spent before then.
Okay. Well, thank you. Okay. Is there objection to Ms. Buckle's motion? Not motion carries. How many did pass? Yeah, I'm sorry, they left the
I let Darren just got to walk in and see what happened.
Why did I get to give you a bad time call?
All right. Schedule is House Bill 884, Technical Amendments to Oil and Gas Taxes. Mr. Messenger is here on behalf of the administration. It is the governor's bill. Mr. Messenger, would you like to go through, walk us through the sections of this bill and tell us what the purpose of the amendments would be and the effect and so forth?
Okay. Chairman, members of the committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Do we have copies of the amendment?
Yes, the amendment's are in House Bill 884.
Okay. So maybe that's up typed out. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is House Bill 884, and basically it makes a few housekeeping or technical amendments to the severance tax statute, basically to clean up a few items in that bill that have been just oversights in the last couple of years. The Section 1 straightens out a conflict in the payment date for the production tax. As the statute reads presently, the tax is due on the 20th day of each month, but then it goes on in that last sentence to say if it's not paid by the end of the month, it's delinquent. So there's a conflict: is it due or not on the 20th or the last day? And so this eliminates that conflict by saying that it's due on the 20th day.
Okay. What does the industry have to say about this? I mean, maybe the industry might say. Have they told you what they're?
Well, I mean, they've talked to our people and think that the 20th day is a little burdensome in terms of administration, in terms of getting the reports and the payment to us by the 20th day. I suppose they would prefer to have it at the end of the month. And
well, what's wrong with that? Is there anything wrong with having them do it by the 30th day? Is there anything?
The only thing is it would give us the interest on that additional 10 days, just be the cash flow. Had the money in the bank 10 days earlier. But the main thing we're trying to do is to get a consistent date there, either the 20th or the last day.
Okay. You say right now the way it stands.
Right now, as it stands, we really can't enforce.
You say 20, and they say 30. That's
right. Right.
Mr. Frame.
Chairman, I'm reading this. Cover letter here from the governor. It doesn't take much time on that, but it does. I have some questions that I need to ask about. It says the bill would amend the press provision of law and oil and gas production tax to allow the Department of Revenue to determine a reasonable cost of transportation and calculating gross value of oil and gas when there is reasonably the actual cost of are not reasonable. And on down it says, allow the Department of Revenue to compute reasonable transportation costs where a taxpayer's actual transportation costs are not the result of good faith transaction. That seems to me like it's putting an awful lot of power in the hands of the Department of Revenue to. Whether they just simply say, well, this is a reasonable amount, don't we have some way to determine what's reasonable other than somebody just saying this is not reasonable or that's reasonable?
That provision is in Section 2, and I thought maybe we could cover Section 1 first and go into the other thing. I happen to have been the initial author of that, of the bill as it stands now, of the language as it stands now. So if you Bond, do you have any comments on this 20-day thing?
I haven't heard our company comment on this particular section.
I don't want to set up anything that's unnecessarily burdensome, but I do think we ought to get it straight.
If we change. What's the return to the state then in that 10-day period? Have we got any kind of a figure that how much money we're going to make off of this changing that for that 10-day period?
I don't, just off the top of my head, I don't have those figures, but over the year it'd probably be a few thousand dollars.
I think really the question whether or not it's an unnecessary, whether the companies really have time to get it together in that 20-day period, whether they ought to have it 30 days, I think that's really the only question to be decided.
I think that, Mr. Chairman, again, if there's not a terrific amount of money involved here, there might be more money involved in the paperwork by closing up the gap and just let them have their 30 days.
I think, John, apparently the real problem here is just straightening it out one way or the other, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do, just so that everybody understands when it's due, and it's either the 20th or the 30th, so that, you know, so that it works.
The administration feel real strongly about the extra 10 days?
Not really strong.
All right, just okay. Right.
But right now, it doesn't seem to make much difference. I think we ought to give the industry a chance to explain why they might need extra 10, if you think. I mean, if they need it, we ought to give it to them, it seems to me. But if they don't, then, you know.
Well, I think the testimony was that they did need 10 days.
That they did?
Through Mr. Messenger, we did ask him in his comments, but I don't know if it's all anymore. Okay. Anything further on section one? I think that,
Mr. Chairman, if you're saying the 30th day, some days are 30, some days are 31, some days, some months are, you know, well, 1 month is 28, 29 days. I really don't see, if we're going to give them the 30 days, I really don't see any change, why we should change it. It says the end of the month.
Well,
I mean, I think it is specific. It doesn't say a date.
But it says it's due on the 20th. That's the card.
I know.
Well, it would be easy.
A lot of time, yeah.
It would be very easy for the committee to just say it's due on the last day of each calendar month.
Yeah.
Or that being sure said.
Okay.
Okay. Well, let's go on. This real substantive change, I believe, would be section two anyhow. We'll make a decision on this other thing. John?
Okay. Section two makes an corrective amendment to a provision which was added to the severance tax bill, I believe it was 3 years ago, which gave the department authority to determine reasonable costs of transportation if circumstances arose where the actual costs were not reasonable, in terms of if the tanker company was an affiliate of the producer or the pipeline company or there was other non-arm's length sort of transactions. And the problem arose is that in reading the statute, for some reason there was a problem in the draft in how the bill finally came out in terms of drafting, and that it reads as if that all three of these various conditions have to exist before the department could come in and make an adjustment to the transportation costs. And this just makes absolutely sure that the authority exists if any one of the three, not all three at the same time. Basically, what we're talking about is if we have a condition where we have an affiliated tanker company or an arm's length transaction, that the department can look at, can go in and do an audit and investigate what the actual costs are, and then that are being claimed, and then match that up with comparable rates. What otherwise would be, let's say, what the going rate for tanker costs is on the West Coast, or what if they had contracted with a third party, what the cost would have been. And so would limit the amount of cost of what they could claim to that amount which what the market would show, rather than what they actually made a deal with their own company about.
Okay. Just for the edification of the committee, I sort of put this thing together when? 2 years ago, was it?
I think it was 2 or 3 years ago.
Two, right? Or 3 years ago, and I did pass into law at that time. It was certainly my intent that only where either of these conditions exists, the commissioner can come in and question plane transportation costs. And I think we're not doing anything more here than what we intended to do 2 or 3 years ago, and I don't know whether. I thought this was the way
thing read, read anyhow. I'll go to show you what happens in the closing day of, days of the session. Anyway, I'm sure there are questions on this particular section. Mr. Freeman, you had,
I was trying to find out if that's a normal procedure for the, to give the, or if there's any other vehicle or other, any other method or any other way to make that determination as to whether or not it was a reasonable cost, other than just have the, give the commissioner the power to say, well, this is not reasonable. I mean, just, that's, my first reaction was that seems to give a power is an arbitrary decision. Normal.
It is done, the Internal Revenue Service does this type of thing. Ultimately, of course, the courts decide whether it's reasonable or not. after the determination is made by the commissioner. But I guess it's just one of those things where it's the best mechanism that anybody can think of. I think it's probably the fairest way to say. But it is, this type of thing is done by the Internal Revenue Service, especially where there's some evidence of self-dealing, for instance, so, you know, people charging, overcharging their own affiliates or undercharging their own affiliates and this sort of thing, and what's called step transactions, where, you know, it looks like a series of things that are innocuous in themselves. If you look at the whole transaction, you discover that a straw man, and this is not by way of saying that this is happening or not, but if it is, I do think that the state ought to be allowed to step in and make its own determination. It is legal to do that. And,
Chairman,
but yeah.
What does the reason of the word the gross do to the law? What does it mean? It mean that the companies would make the necessary deductions before the actual cost is determined?
Chairman, what that does is last year, after the severance tax changes last year, that term gross value was essentially changed to just be value. And this would just make that conform to the way the statute now reads for other provisions. It's now the value, and they just gross is just kind of a unnecessary word at this point.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Messer is probably telling me to answer this. What's the relationship to this bill to House Bill 878 and resources? Are you playing with that one?
Yes, I am.
Have you got a journal?
They're two different. There are two different issues involved. They're not really tied to one another. The 878 is a more substantive bill in terms of setting the floor tax rate, and whereas this is making clarifications in the statute, technical amendments, and also conforming to what was the previous intent. Whereas 878 actually raises the cents per barrel tax rate in the severance tax.
The reason I ask that question, I see this bill, that this is the only referral it had.
The difference is, you know, this bill would curb abuses if any exist. And I might be in order to point out that on page 2, lines 6 and 7, the transportation costs fixed by tariff rates with either the Pipeline Commission or any other regulatory agency are prima facie reasonable. The presumption is you've had a fair hearing, an impartial body has set the rates, and that goes. But before there's been no such hearing, then perhaps we ought to be allowed to look into it a little further. Okay. Is there further is there anything further now? Any further questions on section two? Any further comments you'd like to make, John, on that section?
No, I can't think of anything else.
Okay, section three repeals certain parts of the law that relate to delinquency of returns. What's the reason for that now?
Okay, I think it was a year or two ago, we adopted a uniform set of penalty and interest provisions that apply to all taxes that the Department of Revenue administers. And at that time, we went through all the statutes and thought we had repealed all of the extra ones that conflicted, and we missed them here in the production tax statute. So we eliminate the interest provision and the penalty provision here in the separate severance tax and make them apply, make the general uniform penalty and interest apply to the severance tax, just like every other tax.
Okay. Is there anything further? Are there further questions on this?
Question on section four, retroactive to January 1, 1977. What would be the rationale for that?
I think that. Mr. Chairman, that's a pretty standard provision that we've put in the in our tax bills to make it apply concurrently with the year that we're making the change, and we're not. I don't think we're making any changes that are particularly burdensome on the industry, and anything that's not conflicting with what was. With regard to transportation, what was the intent of the legislature previous? So we're just picking a date so that we're not running into different tax years and that sort of thing. We're just, so it begins at the start of the year.
Let me re-ask the question. What difference would it make if it says retroactive to January 1, 1978?
Okay, I see what you're saying there. Well, I suppose you could do that. I guess our thought was that with regard to the transportation section, that was something that's been intended all along, and it should apply to the beginning of Prudhoe Bay production as well as continuing from this point on.
I might just give a more, perhaps, straightforward answer to that. I think perhaps some indication that these tanker charges are overblown and it stretches into 77. I guess that's about as straight as I don't know whether they have or not. But I do know that the tanker charges have been claimed have been far, far in excess of anything that has been projected.
In other words, Mr. Chairman, the difference between 77 and 78 wasn't just some accident or typo.
I believe
that's the point. I just want to know.
It could be in terms of millions of dollars, to be honest with you.
I just want to know what.
Mr. Chairman, the Prudhoe Bay production began in the middle of last year, and this would make it apply to that.
Okay, are there further questions on this bill? would you like to comment on the bill?
Just one short statement, if I may. Is it simply, I think, this is trying to cure the same problems we're trying to cure under House Bill 778, and that's the protection of the wellhead value. Personally, or my company's point of view, I think we'd rather like to wait and see these two bills finally considered together than these changes that are proposed in this bill now and the one that's downstairs.
Well, I might point out that the floor, or some reply, that any of it, to me, question of whether a floor should be established is a policy question that I think is quite different from this one. This is just essentially to shore up the law that presently exists. And, you know, even if all the tanker charges, if you find that all the tanker charges are properly justified, the floor would have an additional effect on that if the charges drove the wellhead price down beyond that point. So I do think it's two separate questions. We appreciate your viewpoint. Okay, is there anything further on this bill? Okay, if not, I'd like to make a motion to say for anybody else. I'd like to move that we report out of committee substitute for House Bill 884. Section 1 would read, the gross production tax on oil or gas shall be paid monthly. The tax is due on the last day of each calendar month on oil and gas produced from each lease of property during the preceding month. That gives the company some extra time here. Apparently, indeed, it does straighten up that whatever that dispute was. John, would you prefer to, you still want to take out this language that says if the tax is not paid before the end of the month it becomes delinquent? You want to take that stuff out?
Yeah, I don't think it's needed.
Okay. And that the remainder of the bill remain as is. Is there an objection to that motion?
I'm
not quite know
why we have this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rowe, with regard to pipelines, those are regulated either by the federal government or by the state. But with regard to, for instance, tanker transportation, there is no regulatory body that regulates those charges. Those are just determined by negotiation between the various companies. So, yes, the Pipeline Commission does sign off on pipeline charges, but there is no regulatory agency that does tanker transportation.
We were having a study of making tanker charges. And there's a study in a way to find out what the tanker charges actually are. Well, these software panel.
Yeah, I believe there's a study which is just in a Senate Bill 118, I believe, is it, which would provide money to actually do a study to determine what should be the reasonable, what are the reasonable costs of transportation. And so that would do the study of it, and this just gives the authority to use whatever information would be available. And so, you know, it's two things. One is the study to provide information, and this is the authority to do something with the information once it's determined.
Okay. Is the objection maintained, Mr. Brooks?
Yeah, that's fine.
Excuse me, we don't have to get that.
No, I'll lift your hold and check.
Okay. Okay, the motion then carries. How many good passes do we have? Okay, tomorrow we're going to take an initial step into looking into the Renewable Resources Fund. I wouldn't intend to get the bill out tomorrow morning. I'd like to have done it today, but Terry Gardner wanted to be here, and he couldn't be here till tomorrow. And so instead of doing it today and just letting everybody have a day off tomorrow, we are going to have to take it up at 8:30. in the meantime, I'm going to try to get my office into some kind of shape and organize a schedule from here on out. And I probably should start getting a capital request together. Because we've got to put that together in the next 3 or 4 weeks anyhow. Yeah,
right. I want to hear yesterday, do we have a schedule for when the bill's going to be reported to the caucus? I mean, the budget.
Yeah, it would have been ready tomorrow, Russ, but he didn't want to start the caucus on Friday when people leave.
So it'll be Monday or something?
It will be Monday, yeah. I guess Tuesday, right?
I got a hearing of healing on Tuesday, and I probably won't get back here on Wednesday afternoon. If it's in that day, then I won't go.
I think the caucus is really what we're after. We're sort of calendar voting.
Well,
I think the caucus will be through by Tuesday. So you can figure that from there. Maybe be on the field by Wednesday. You never
be on the floor by Wednesday? Well, I have to be here then.
Okay. You want session tomorrow? We go in session tomorrow as far as I know.
Yeah. It's at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Yeah. The Senate, I believe, is taking off, aren't they?
Yeah.
Is it in a meeting room?
No.
Okay.
That's what I was going to work.
Okay. Well, if there's nothing else to be taken up today, then we'll adjourn tomorrow morning. Addressing this morning is House Bill 682, the Renewable Resources Fund. It will be a preliminary hearing, and we wouldn't expect to take final action this morning. In any event, Representative Gardner is here. And Terry, do you want to start us off here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 682 is implementing legislation for the Renewable Resources Fund, which now is already state law and was passed in 1973. This is a product of the work that the Permanent Fund Committee did and was chartered to do when the committee was set up. I think it, as I said yesterday on the floor, it's kind of an integral part of the overall package of legislation that the Permanent Fund Committee introduced. I think one of the things that we heard continually in testimony and through other sources of information from the public, and I believe the same thing myself personally, and I think a lot of legislators do, that one of the things that we want to do in this state is to develop our renewable resource industries, and that to a large extent, this is where the economy of Alaska is going to have to go in the long run. And for many years, at least great portions of the state's economy, and specifically in certain areas, have already been based on renewable resource industries of fisheries and forestry. I might just cite some information that was taken from the public forum, and everybody can always pick out their polls, but I think that this is just one of many that's consistent with any other indicator of public opinion that I've ever seen. And in the first year the public forum was done, they went around, one of the things they asked people was, what do you want to do with the permanent fund? And people kept saying, well, we want to invest it in renewable resources. So to kind of dig in this a little further, some people said, well, that's just kind of a buzzword. People don't really know what renewable resources are. And of course, politicians always think that the public doesn't know what they're talking about. So anyway, the public forum dug into this a little deeper. They asked the question, in last year's public forum, the participants indicated the highest priority for using the permanent fund was to promote renewable resource industries such as fisheries, timber and farming. Do you agree with this? Statewide, 79% of the people answered that they agreed with this concept. And this really, whether you look in rural areas, southeast Alaska, coastal Alaska, Anchorage or Fairbanks, or the interior communities, you find the percentage doesn't vary much. People, whether they live in big cities or little cities, are dependent on renewable resources or not, believe this. Not, additionally, a couple other questions were asked to further go into this. The question was asked, do you feel that the goals you have identified as most important for the permanent fund can be met by investing in renewable resource industries? Again, 77% people said that the concerns they had for the permanent fund could be met by investment in renewable resources. Finally, the question was asked, if you said yes to the previous question, would you still vote to invest renewable resource industries even if the money earned was less than the money that could be earned from other investments? And still, 68% of the people who answered this question said yes. So I think that there's a little doubt in my mind, at least, that people in the state are very concerned about having the state do whatever it can to help develop renewable resources. I think they see that in the long run, that's what Alaska's economy is going to have to be based on, and they agree with that emphasis. So that was really what one of the things that the Permanent Fund Committee was looking at, both that with in the context of the Permanent Fund and the Renewable Resources Fund. And as I said at the beginning, the Renewable Resources Fund already exists. In 1973, Ernie Haugen sponsored a bill that dedicated 5% of oil incomes to the state to renewable resource rehabilitation, enhancement, and development. And this legislation was passed in that year. It did not become effective because there really weren't any oil revenues coming in from Prudhoe Bay. So the effective date was delayed until this year when Prudhoe Bay began to flow. So we already had some givens in terms of a statute that was on the books and that we had to work with. The first question we asked ourselves was, what is the most effective way to use this money that has been dedicated to renewable resources? And we decided, I think as a policy matter, that if we really wanted to stimulate renewable resource industries and a viable economy from those, that we could better accomplish that by directing the money to the private sector rather than to state government. It didn't seem to us that hiring more state agencies to go out and do more things that state agencies do was really in the long run going to accomplish anything other than having a larger state government. So we started looking at what did the private sector need in terms of their efforts to develop renewable resources, and how could this money be funneled to them in an effective way. One of the things, too, that we had to work with is the fact that we're really not talking about large amounts of money. The permanent fund, people keep referring to hundreds of millions and billions of dollars. The renewable resource fund projections that we have, and these are somewhat conservative, but I think that we have to go with those figures now until other questions resolve. In 1978, there's going to be $18 million going to the Renewable Resources Fund, and it grows to about $25 million annually during the peak of the pipeline flow. So we're not talking about a huge amount of money, and there's a limit to the things we can do. So one, in looking at why haven't renewable resource industries developed in this state, one of the big stumbling blocks that we came across was the lack of seed capital. The lack of capital to go in and try out new industries, to work, try out some of the ideas that people think are viable. Generally, there's, I think, a lack of this kind of capital for new industries in Alaska. But specifically with renewable resources, the financial institutions, whether they're in this state or outside the state, really don't have any knowledge about industries such as fisheries, forestry, and agriculture, especially in Alaska. So they're very reluctant to invest money in those. They know a lot about building houses in the state of Alaska and whether somebody's proposing to build a house or a subdivision or an office building in downtown Juneau is a good idea. But they really don't know whether somebody's proposal to build a trawler to go bottom fishing or to try to build a farm in the Delta area based on barley is a good idea or not. They just don't know anything about it, so they're not going to lend money for those purposes. I think another problem is that the businessmen that we have in Alaska are interested in developing our renewable resources are by and large small businessmen by national and world standards. And they don't have access to the kinds of capital that large companies that are in Alaska do. Certainly the Japanese companies that are involved in the bottom fisheries off the state are very large companies, some of the largest in the world, and they have access to capital markets that some small businessmen in Alaska will never get near. So that's what we felt was one of the most appropriate areas that the state could go into, was supplying some seed capital to businessmen and other individuals in Alaska who wanted to develop and renewable resource industries. So we kind of narrowed down the scope, and when I talk about seed capital, think of a development of a commercial business or an industry in these stages. First, there is some amount of general research that I think is already going on in the state to indicate some potential. And I might use the Delta Barley Project as a good example of this. There's been a lot of research done by the university and other federal and state agencies about the potential of the agriculture in interior Alaska. And this is kind of the general informational research nature. Then where we're at in the stage in that project now is we're talking about going in and doing a demonstration project to prove out whether all these ideas that scientists and other people have researched and all these reports have done are true, and to figure out whether the economics really are there before a large-scale industry in the interior based on agriculture can go. You've got to try out those all these ideas that people think are bright ideas. And that phase is commonly known as the research and development and demonstration phase. Now once the industry has been proven up and somebody has gone out into the Delta area and actually developed a farm out there and marketed a product and got a stable price, then he's in a position, and other people are in a position, to go to financial institutions and borrow money because they can show, here's what my proposal is, here's what my profit is going to be, here's how much investment's going to be required. You can show that kind of information. You can't show that kind of information now. It's only somebody's projection. It hasn't been proven. So there's really these three phases to the development of a commercial enterprise. There's the general research that's got to be done to gather the information to try out an idea. There's the research and development and demonstration, and then the final phase of the development and the growth of the industry. What we singled out as the stage that the Renewable Resources Fund could most effectively be involved in was this middle phase of the research and development and demonstration phase. So that brings me to the point of actually talking about what's been drafted up as House Bill 682. And House Bill 682 is a proposal to try to direct the money at this middle phase of development. In the bill, it proposes creating an organization called the Alaska Renewable Resources Corporation that would have as its directive to funnel the funds from the Renewable Resource Fund into the private sector to help them develop renewable resource industries. The bill does not envision that once these industries are started up, that it will go on to finance every renewable resource venture in the state of Alaska. There's simply not enough capital in the Renewable Resource Fund to do that if you wanted to. But to help these industries get on a footing where they can get financing, either from state or federal loan programs or private financial institutions. I'm just talking about the startup phase. So what we propose creating is a renewable resource corporation that has a board of directors of three people, and it would be similar to the structure that's proposed in the permanent fund bill. And one of the things that is different about the renewable resource corporation is that it's required to go through the budget process on an annual basis to provide both the governor and the legislature with a review of how they are investing their money. I think that's the balance that we've tried to create is, one, creating an organization that had the independence and flexibility to make investments as they saw fit, but on the other hand, to provide for a thorough review, and I think that can best be done through the legislative appropriation process. One of the problems we foresaw was that many of these agencies we've set up who are not required to go through the budgeting process, they're fine as long as you have the right individuals running them, but if the wrong guy ever gets in there, they kind of get off the deep end before anybody discovers it, because there's no kind of annual review process. So that's the balance that we have shot for, is a kind of an independent, flexible agency, but that is required to be reviewed in its budget, both its operating budget and its investment budget, on an annual basis. It's not directed, as I said before, towards financing research, as you think of the University of Alaska or the Fish and Game Department doing research studies. That's not what we're aiming for at all. The corporation has a wide range of investment powers. It can make grants, although we've severely limited that to 10% of their annual appropriation, and there's quite a few other restrictions on what grants are going to be used for. We're really trying to have this agency make investments, not to just dole out money, because we're not trying to fund projects that are not going to be economically viable. That's the whole idea, is to help stimulate projects which have economic viability. The board is also required to go through a very rigorous evaluation process, as spelled out in the bill, and to make written findings before they make an investment, so that there is a record that they can be accountable for as to why they made an investment and what the information was that they made that investment on. Again, this is, relates to the accountability of the organization. Now, in the original legislation that is on the books today, it provides for a so-called Renewable Resource Development Fund. 5% of the oil revenues comes into the Renewable Resource Development Fund, and then if it is not spent in a given year, it flows into a Renewable Resource Permanent Fund. Now, we changed the name to Renewable Resource Investment Fund so that there wouldn't be confusion in people's minds about two different permanent funds. So you have the system where the money comes in to the development fund. If it's not spent annually, it goes into the investment fund, and that investment fund builds up to a total of $250 million, and at which point the whole act that provides for the flow of the oil revenues is repealed. Now, that's the existing law. What we have provided for in this bill is that 50% of the funds will go into the Alaska Renewable Resource Corporation, which is outlined in House Bill 682, and the other 50% will automatically flow in to the investment fund. And we had wrestled with this problem for a long time. How do you prevent any agency or the legislature or the governor or whoever from spending all the money so that you never end up with any money in the investment fund? Because at some point the oil revenues are going to decline, and then all your funds for renewable resource development are going to be dried up. The idea was that you would have this investment fund that would build up capital, and then the interest off that could be used in the future to fund the same programs. So we have just made an arbitrary decision that we were going to make sure that money flowed into the investment fund, and there was not this incentive each year to spend all the money we got for renewable resources. So the bill provides for 50% to go into the corporation and 50% to go into the investment fund. I think in your packet of information there is a chart that shows how the money flows, and also a financial projection that shows the buildup of the investment fund in the corporation. One other thing that the bill provides, and that is that the investment returns that the corporation itself earns would flow back to the corporation for further investment. But again, these funds would be subject to the annual budget process before they could be reinvested. And I think that pretty well covers what the concept behind the bill was and what's in the bill.
Okay. Just so as I can get it straight, Terry, there's a 50% allocation to the investment fund through 3712050, and then whatever you don't spend goes in there too, right? Whatever's left, the other 50% that you don't need, that goes into the permanent.
Well, as the bills, that would be right. If the legislature failed to appropriate the money to the Alaska Renewable Resources Corporation or to some other purpose, then it would go into the investment fund at the end of the year.
Oh, is it a legislative appropriation then, or the corporation itself?
No, it's a legislative appropriation. The legislature, the bill provides for an authorization, but they cannot spend any money till the legislature appropriates it each year.
Okay. No, I guess what I'm getting at is if the legislature should appropriate, say, well, I don't know, $20 million to the corporation, and the corporation only uses $15 million, does that extra $5 million revert into the permanent fund, or does it?
No.
Not the permanent fund, the renewable resources investment fund.
Terry, isn't that taken care of on page 14, section 4?
No, there's actually, I'm trying to find the other section, because we had this problem that if you allocate them a certain amount of money, we didn't want to do like certain agencies have now, that at the end of the year they just start spending the money to get rid of it so it won't lapse.
Yeah.
So we provided that they would retain the money. But see, the point is they come in at the next year and they ask for a new appropriation. Well, they've got to justify why they haven't spent it. So we didn't want to create this incentive where they would just go out and spend the money to get rid of it to show, well, we need more money this year.
Well, so they have an incentive to do that anyhow, Terry. I mean, it seems to me that that's just more related to administrative sorts of agencies than it would be for this kind of thing.
Well, you guys know a lot more about why agencies spend all their money than I do sitting up here.
But
actually, this, you know, was. I know Jim worked with us on this section trying to figure out how we could not build incentives in for them just to be making investments for the sake of investments, but only making them when they really had a sound proposal.
Okay, Mr. Freeman, Terry, back in 1973 when Mr. Howden first came up with this idea, originally his, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he concentrated and pointed the thing directly at the fishery. And the idea was supposed to be, as I understood at that time, that it would be proper to take a percentage of our non-renewable resource income and devote that to renewable resources. And I prevailed upon Mr. Haugen at that time to broaden it a little beyond fish and include farming and timber and other non-renewable resources. But at that time, at least in my mind, I thought what we were trying to do was to use the money to build fish hatcheries and, you know, help the non-renewable resources, forestry, any way we could. But at the time, I never envisioned that we would rather than using the money to produce more fish, we would, for instance, use the money to lend it to people to buy bigger and better vessels to harvest more of an easier what fish we got. To me, it's completely turned around from what I originally envisioned it. And it seems to me that we're kind of getting carried away with investment. I know when the Commissioner of Natural Resources was here, of Revenue was here testifying on the permanent fund bill, he was making a big argument that we should put 50% into development because we needed to make all these loans to buy these $3 million fishing boats. Maybe I'm missing something here, but it seems to me like that what you have done here, you've created another
what do you call it, the Alaska Development Corporation, the 5% or the 1/6 in the permanent fund bill? Enterprise, all right. You've duplicated that, except the other one is, that was a place where you could make loans and investments to all kinds of enterprises, and this one is practically what? Limited to fish, right? You know, what kind of loans are you going to make to individuals in forestry? What kind of loans are you going to make in the farming? We're not that far into farming. I never had any quarrel in the beginning with using the, you know, using this fund to enhance and develop. But to me, that's a far cry from going out and, you know, lending people money to harvest what renewable resources we have now. It seems to me like it's maybe I haven't followed it closely enough. It seems to me like it's a different approach, a different philosophy altogether than what we intended in the beginning.
I probably didn't explain that too well, what I meant by investment. For one thing, we're not really talking about making loans in the sense of just becoming some kind of banking institution to give low interest loans or subsidize somebody. Let me give an example. A couple years ago, the legislature appropriated $300,000 to help promote bottom fish. And instead of doing more studies, what was said was, what we need is some actual proof that a bottom fish industry can work in this state, and that what everybody says is there's a great potential out there is true. So a contract was signed with two companies, Petersburg Fisheries Incorporated, Petersburg and New England Fish. What the state did in that contract, they said, look, we'll help you by doing the following. We'll give you $150,000 to guarantee a price per pound to the fishermen. And you go out there and catch fish and process and market the fish. And then at the point when you make a profit, you're going to pay us back the money. But we want to, rather than hiring the University of Alaska or the Fish and Game Department to go research bottom fish, we really want to see, get fishermen out there and see what the potential really is. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about doing. Loaning them money wouldn't have done them any good because they really didn't have any profit to return to start paying it back next month. What they had to go out and do was catch fish, get the fillet machines in place, try it out, see where the market was. They didn't have a market for the product at that point. They do now. But the idea was to help stimulate them with some risk capital. Right? The state put up $150,000. The company and the fishermen put up, you know, a lot of money too. They put up their time, their boats, the expenses to run out there. They didn't know if they were going to make anything or not. Nobody really did. Everybody had done all these wonderful studies that said they would. But now, both of those companies are going operations on bottom fish as a result of a small investment of money. The state is going to have that money repaid. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about. You know, people talk all the time about these great potential industries of, you know, bottom fish or clams or agriculture in the interior, but we've got to give the people who want to do that some money to go out and actually try those to prove it up. If we tried now to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in those industries before they're really proven as to whether they're viable, we may lose our shirts. You know, nobody's really proven whether it'll work, and that's what we're trying to direct this at, not by just going out and competing against banks. We don't envision competing with banks at all. The banks would not have, you know, given a guarantee fund to a company and said, well, if you make money, you know, then we want to share in the profits. They would have made them a conventional loan and said, well, you know, every 30 days you're going to start paying back at 12% interest, which really wouldn't have done them any good. Otherwise, they would have done that.
Mr.
Terry, I'm sure you didn't miss my point, but it was, you know, I can see, you know, small amounts, small loans, $150,000 or whatever, you know, that's peanuts what we're talking about when we start talking about 5%. But, you know, if it's 150 grand or something, I wouldn't mind that on a research bit. But once the discovery is made that they're there, it seems to me that then the funds should be used to grow more bottom fish or build more salmon hatcheries or this kind of thing. But I can't see the long run benefit, you know. It seems to me that the thing we want to do, the idea in the beginning was to use the non-renewable resource income to build more renewable resources, and rather than just harvest them. I don't see any great advantage. I can see it, you know, there is an advantage, but obviously anything that we can do to help more Alaskans make more money, that, you know, that's a benefit. But I can't see the rationale for using it other than the enhancement of the renewable resources. That's the part I don't see. And when you start, you know, financing fishing boats on a large scale, or you know, whatever, I'm not picking on the fishermen, but then it seems every time you talk about extra money, fish comes up. So you know, if you're going to grow more fish, you know, enhance our renewable resources, that I can understand. But just to come up with a more efficient method or more desirable method of harvesting without enhancing them and making them grow and having something to fall back on after the non-renewables resources are gone, I fail to see the connection.
Mr. Greening.
Well, I want Terry may want to respond to that, but I just have a comment more on your point. If you're talking about a different kind of fishery, like getting in the bottom fishery, I think that relates very much to the existing fishery. In other words, you have equipment out there that's being used as a very specialized fishery. If you develop a fishery in a different area, I think if you're enabling a management program that doesn't I think there's a lot of pressure on, say, the salmon fishery to fish that to the fullest extent so people can make a living. If you diversify the fisheries operations, what you're doing, I think, is enhancing the remaining fishery. In other words, the fisherman doesn't have to rely on that one particular fishery. And I think the stage we're now at is not a question of just harvest. It's a question of developing it as an adjunct to the existing fishery. And I think overall it takes some of the pressure off the existing fishery. And what you're doing by developing or spreading out your harvest capability, you really are enhancing. But in addition to that, there are, this corporation, as I understand it, would have the ability to look into enhancement methods. But by diversifying your fishery, you are really taking pressure off existing fishery, or should be anyway.
I gather what we're doing here with all of these bills is establishing a coordinated, integrated mechanism that works from the time a renewable resources industry is conceived until the time that it becomes commercially feasible. It seems to me that that's where you're going. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, Oral, if we're just talking about funding fish hatcheries, I mean, you know, I've pushed as much as any legislator for funding fish hatcheries, and I'm always glad to see the Finance Committee build more fish hatcheries in my district so I can catch more fish, you know, and be popular with all my friends who are commercial fishermen like I am. But, you know, first of all, that, you know, if you're going to take, you know, 50% of this money, like this year, would be about $8 or $9 million. Well, that's probably going to build about 1.5 fish hatcheries. That's fine. If we want to dump it all into fish hatcheries, I'll probably be for that. But, you know, we are talking about fisheries, forestry, and agriculture. And, you know, I think that the roadblock to a lot of these things is developing the techniques to do things. And I don't think that, you know, the problem with fish hatcheries in this state for a long time had been how to have a fish hatchery that worked. The conventional fish hatcheries that have been used for many, many years, as it turned out, destroyed more fish than they built. And really, the people who figured out gravel incubation and stream spawning channels were really the smart people, rather than just building more hatcheries and such as they that were failing. And we're really only talking about a pretty small amount of money relative to the $500 million the state is going to have to put in to build all the necessary fish hatcheries. That's what the state's plan is now, and with inflation it's probably going to be a lot more than $500 million. That figure is about 3 years old now. And you know, I just felt that personally, although I'm all for building fish hatcheries, that we had to look a little broader than just building fish hatcheries if we're talking about renewable resource industries in the state. Let's just take, what's the corollary of building fish hatcheries for agricultural development? You know, start thinking about that and looking at what does agricultural development in this state, the things that people in the interior are very interested in, what do they need to help them? Is it low interest loans? They can get low interest loans through all the agricultural cooperatives and stuff. That isn't the problem. So what is the problem with agriculture? Why hasn't it taken off in Alaska? And as far as we could tell, the reason it has, because these ideas that people say have great potential, nobody's put the capital in to go out and try these ideas out. And that's what this bill attempts to do, is to say we're going to go in to agriculture or fisheries or forestry and try these ideas out. And obviously you just don't want to fund the first thing wild scheme that somebody has along, and that's why this mechanism was set up as it was, to try to figure out, you know, what is a good investment of these dollars.
I've got a question here. Anytime we talk about renewable resources, somebody always brings in tourism. Now, I've always thought that it's stretching the definition pretty good ways. As I read the definition on page 12, section 7, it would not include tourism. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, it doesn't say per se whether it includes tourism or not. In my feeling with the definition, it certainly doesn't include building hotels. You know, if somebody had a tourism-related proposal that related to development of renewable resources, then it might qualify. But in terms of, you know, the things that we think of as tourism industry, building a hotel, you know, or a convention center, or something like that, you know, I don't think it qualifies.
Would it be the intention then of the committee not to include tourism? Because I think it ought to be spelled out, really.
I think that's up to you. I don't have any strong feelings about it. I mean, I feel like we certainly aren't trying to get in the business of doing hotels and what have you.
Well, I think we've got enough loan funds and stuff to cover tourism. The other question I have with respect to the definition, and it's on page 13 of the committee substitute, line 20, is mention of the definition of renewable resources being also energy systems which are naturally recurring or replenished. Does that refer to hydro projects?
Yeah, I think hydro, geothermal, you know, tidal or wind energy. You know, obviously, like, petroleum isn't naturally reoccurring, except maybe in the
How would that coordinate with what the Alaska Power Authority's duties are?
Well, I think that, you know, their duties are to more or less to finance, you know, something. And like I say, this wasn't really looking at financing something in terms of projects. But for instance, when we were in Kotzebue, there was talk, they're right on a geothermal incline there, and they talked about not only using the geothermal power for heat and power, but also for a fish hatchery that they want to go in, because it's one of your big problems with a hatchery is in an interior area where it's really cold is keeping, you know, heating the water. And if you have to import petroleum to heat all the water, it just gets atrociously expensive. And I think maybe, you know, in terms of a demonstration of an energy project, that would be fundable. But again, we have a hydro project in my district's going to cost $68 million. It would eat up half of this fund for the next 5 or 10 years. And I want to see that project funded, but this is probably not the way to finance hydro.
Okay. On another matter, the governor sent a letter that's in everybody's files on February the 23rd, expressing certain proposed changes. Were those changes addressed by the committee?
Yeah, they were addressed by the committee, and I think about half of them were adopted, maybe more. And we do have a list of that, and some of the ones were not. One of the ones that I think is an important difference is the administration would like the Renewable Resources Fund to basically be one of the agencies within divisions within the department. And we've, I think that's the most fundamental objection. We did not adopt that.
Mr. Haugen.
Well, of course, I'm a little bit distressed with this bill because it's so far away from the original idea of what the Renewable Resource Bill was. And it was to enhance the Route 50 enhancement projects, forest reforestation, and agriculture. And somehow or another, they got tourism hooked onto it, but I'm not going to talk about that. But I just want to relate to you what has happened since that time. Of course, the fund never had any money, but I think it was in the 1976 bond issue, we had $30 million worth of hatcheries, and today, not half of them are even under construction. The idea was to pay for these projects cash out of the earnings of that fund, although we would have, I guess we would have been slow getting started. But I think if we had plans in hand and had the ability this year with $18 billion, we could have put a part of it and built probably some hatcheries. today, the Fred Division budget, as a result of that hatchery bond issue, is a $9.4 million budget this year. And before they ever get one fish back, we're going to have $30, $35 million in that in the overhead. Get to that point, plus the debt service on that $30 million bond issue. So we're going to wind up, it's going to cost us close to $100 million before we, by the time we get the debt service paid and get any return on that effort. And I think it's probably 7 or 8 years by the time all those things are on stream. This really bothers me. Now you talk about agriculture. We've made all kinds of attempts to get agriculture off the ground in this state. And I think it's a worthwhile effort. But the problem is there is no market for the majority of the things that you can produce. Only those vegetable and potato crops that, and I guess some beef projects in the state. In addition to that, I'm getting more concerned every day that the development of energy in the state, which is a real crying need, is not getting the attention it deserves. I got an editorial right out of here on the Anchorage Times that talks about the kilowatt crisis in this state and what the people in the bush are having to pay for a kilowatt hour, 37.2 cents. I think this is where we're going to have to give some real attention, and I'd like to see this bill and the philosophy of it completely turned around to do the things that we originally talked about in renewable resource development of the three principal industries in this state: fisheries, agriculture, and timber. Every one of them will, if we do the things right, will certainly fit the concept of preserving the future economy of the state. I don't know, I could say a lot more, but there's been a lot of work done on this bill without my participation, and I'm on that subcommittee, and maybe part of it's my own fault, I don't know. But I would like to give this bill some time to have some more thought to it, rather than to go off on a bunch of far-out ideas, which in my opinion they are, and do the things that we know what we can do. We've had it demonstrated by the Japanese government, you know, that their technology is available to us, that we can do a lot to bring our existing fishery resources back to an economic level, because there's a market in our own country for that fish. When you get into the bottom fishery, it's just, and I think if you want to learn something about what is happening, you just go down here to Peterburg and see what's happening. They are getting into the industry, they found their old markets, and they've got the fishermen there, they've got the docks, the cold storage, the whole thing. And with that little bit of help they got from the state, I happen to know that that money's gonna be returned to the state.
Mr. Graney, Ms. Buck.
Well, I just wanna second what Ernie says in terms of hydroelectric. I think there's a need to start addressing these projects, and I think particularly in southeast, and there's some projects in the westward that I think should be put on track so that no more time is wasted in terms of getting them going. The question we have to address, of course, is the vehicle, and I think we have an Alaska Power Authority, but in its present status, there needs to be some changes made in order to get it going so that it can start examining some of these projects. I think in terms of feasibility, the place is not the legislature to determine feasibility, but I do think the place to determine the subsidy that is needed, say, to get some of these projects going. And by subsidy, I mean that amount, or that interest rate that's required to get a project of a certain size established beyond what the private market will provide. And I think what we need to address after addressing the power authority is what mechanism to provide the subsidy. And I think that's, we might as well get it out. And I think, I'm not against that kind of subsidy, because I think in the long run, it's paid back. In other words, in terms of the rising costs of power and the environmental advantage to hydroelectric, at least some of the projects they're properly examined, warrants us establishing, probably to be administered maybe by the APA, some kind of program that will enable some projects to go that otherwise couldn't get private financing. And I think it's a question that we've gone around with the permanent fund and now this vehicle, but I think we have to establish a principle here in terms of deciding how we're going to approach the question of subsidy. And I think we ought to do it this session.
Well, I'd like to add something. Now, those communities that are involved in this, now, there isn't a single one of them that their main principle is that they want to pay the money back. But what they need is the front-end financing and a low rate of interest in the early years. And the interest rate is predicated on an accelerated rate of interest so that the state can earn, I would say, a figure 6 or 8% over the average life of the long-term financing. If you really add up what you would be paying in interest over that long term, it is a horrendous pile of money. But when you relate that against the cost of creating that energy with hydrocarbon fuels, and I can show you an example right in my own community, it cost us 1.2 cents per kilowatt to produce electricity with hydropower. That includes the debt service on the hydro plant. It cost us 6.7 cents a kilowatt to produce that same energy with hydroelectric power. And you eat up the source of that, or the production, faster than you can pay the debt service. So before you get that project paid for, you already added some more debt to it. And that's the good thing about going to a substantial-sized hydro, which these communities can't finance at the moment. Get them off the ground, and from that point out, the return to the consumers and the benefits, social benefits to the state, maintaining the viability of those communities, getting them off the welfare rolls, providing economic growth, full employment, it's probably the greatest thing we could do with this revenue from the non-renewable resource.
Ms. Buckholz had a question back a little while ago.
Mr. Chairman, I am following Ernie and others. I know that we have discussed the applicability of this funding to fisheries and hydroelectric powers and so forth. I was thinking of these new ventures that might take place in a smaller community. I'm looking into the section of financial assistance where you define an applicant to be qualified. I have questions there because, again, on page 9 where it says that the applicants must come from the region, would be preferred if they came from the regions where the industry or the project is being proposed. Then, on page 8, it says the applicant must demonstrate sufficient technical and business expertise to accomplish these objectives as proposed in the project. My problem is this, if this new ventures that may come about where you don't have the expertise from the regions, what's going to happen to the proposed project? Will they get any kind of consideration? Although under the eligibility section, it says that you could get a partner from outside who may know a lot about the project that you are proposing. My only concern with that is that more and more we would have to, if we are very strict on the applications, we'll find people venturing, joint venturing with people from outside. And although that is quite prevalent now in the state, I think we'll probably see more of that. And what I would like to see is that although this corporation is supposed to provide some kind of assistance to applicants and their pre-planning section, I don't know to what extent that is going to take place, and this is where maybe Terry could enlighten me.
I'm not quite sure what your question is. It's that you don't want them to be able to joint venture with anybody that's not a resident of the area that they live in?
Well, the assistance section limits, in a way.
Well, we were trying to do two things. One was that we were trying to direct it towards resident individuals and corporations as much as we could. And then two, that that we wanted the board to consider if they're going to, you know, try to start some industry in an area, that the preferences of the people who live there, we wanted them to consider that. We didn't want, you know, the local people necessarily be able to veto it, but obviously the board should consider what the people in the local area were interested in.
What happens if they don't qualify according to the very strict standards specified in the financial assistance section?
Well, why wouldn't they qualify?
Well, because they may not have the ability
to
do the work that they are proposing to do, which would mean that they would have to buy their technical assistance from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And it may be that these ventures are outside of the state, and that, you know, how are we going to develop the expertise within that section of the state where they could do their own thing rather than continually getting the expertise elsewhere?
Well, we're trying to, you know, we do have this section on page 12 on technical assistance to try to get at the problem, but one of the problems you get into is you don't want to, you know, everybody that has a wild scheme, you don't want to have to be mandated to fund them. So you have to have some ability to decide whether they're capable of doing what they proposed. I mean, if I propose to, you know, go up and farm in the Delta area, you know, people ought to be able to, you know, somebody ought to be able to decide whether I'm qualified to do that and reject me if I'm not.
You know, I got nothing.
You know, I agree with you. Maybe there is a need for, you know, increased training or management experience for Alaskan individuals who want to get into business, but there's kind of a limit to how much you can do in one organization. You know, maybe we need more courses at the University of Alaska to help train people, or something like that. But we weren't trying to necessarily build an educational or training institution.
I still have problems with
that. I can explain some of it. I'll tell you what the biggest problem at home right now in the spotting fishing effort that's taking place there right now is to have people that can make up the gear that it takes to catch those fish. They hired a Japanese fishing captain to come over there about 3 weeks ago, and he was out there with one of the most productive fishermen we have, and he wasn't catching one tenth of the fish that was available that you could see right on the meter. That's the kind of technical assistance you need there. Those that know how to run the electronics and stuff that are associated with those drags that are going out there. Another thing, it's the same way with people that know how to handle the product, fillets. You ought to see the mess. They come in there with 100,000 pounds of fish, and they get four or five guys out of Seattle that are pros at it, and those kind of training programs. Those are the things I can see some value for that. Another thing we're short on in that relation is the workforce. They're gonna have to import people up here to work in those industries. In fact, I talked to Mr. Snyder this morning from Kodiak. They have 1,500 people in that community that are from outside of the state. We got to train some of our own people to get them in there, get them off the unemployment and welfare.
But, Terry,
I just mentioned one thing. One of the problems you get into with it, if you talk about renewable resources, everybody's got a great idea and they all cost millions and millions of dollars. Like Mr. Hogan pointed out, the Fred Division operational budget alone is $9.4 million. If you let those the people who work down the Fred Division, they'd eat up the whole renewable resources fund. And Mr. Hogan further pointed out, they really haven't produced any fish yet. And on the other hand, there's a lot of other proposals. I know Mr. Swanson's been pushing for several years to get this Delta thing going, and that's going to take several millions of dollars. And we've got hydro that in the next 10 years is probably going to need about $1 billion for hydro development. And you start coming down to the proposition, there's only 18, $25 million a year in this. It's not going to do all those jobs at once. And so you got to start deciding, what do you want the money to do?
I'd like to make an observation, and that is clearly what we're doing is trying to set up some kind of mechanism that will take an idea and evaluate the idea, and then do the necessary research and the pilot programs that are necessary to see if the idea is any good or not, and then figure out if we're talking about a fledgling industry or perhaps expanding an existing industry and it can't be done through the normal commercial channels, then we get into the act to that extent also. And I think it's important to make the mechanism smooth so you don't have 8 or 10 different agencies doing the same thing. But I think it's also important, and this is something that hasn't been